Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to give this presentation. I've been in discussion with the organizers for a couple of weeks on you know, something that might be useful and cover a range of policy issues. And what we decided we finally decided upon was to talk about, you know, kind of three different related subjects. The first is just kind of some background on what is public policy, which I think is important because oftentimes it's a term policy that gets thrown around a lot, but even those working within the policy field are not always clear about what they mean by it. And it does have a specific usage, and it is a specific field. So that's kind of part one. Part two is kind of a background of on how some space policy decisions are made, and in particular, those that involve an interagency process that goes to the president for a decision. That's been something that I've been focusing on the last few years as part of my doctoral research. And so that's kind of part two, is how that works and how that's evolved over time. And then part three, the organizers asked me to talk about some of the policy issues that are being debated right now, and that are likely to have a major impact on space activity, space operations going ahead into the future. So if you go ahead and flip to slide three, you know, begin with the basics, which is basically what is public policy? And I've got listed on a slide here a few different quotes from some of the public policy textbooks and other sources. And of these, for me personally, I think the last two are the ones that I like to focus on. The Parsons quote, which talks about how public policy is, you know, how issues and problems come to be defined and how they are placed in the political and policy agenda. And then the last quote from Heidenheimer et al., which talks about how and to what, why and to what effect governments pursue a particular course of action or inaction. So public policy is really about, you know, how does the government choose which issues it needs to make a decision on? How does it go about making that decision or not making the decision? And then what is the actual decision it makes? And that encompasses a whole range of things, everything from what is the process to how you make decisions to how you actually implement the decisions, something called the public administration. So if you flip to slide four, a lot of policy analysis is actually very, very similar to economic analysis, because the field has become dominated by economics, or at least economic thinking. So when people talk about doing some sort of a rational policy analysis, the typical method is to define alternative courses of actions, or in the Pentagon terms, COAs. You then kind of assign costs and benefits of each of the alternatives, and you choose the alternative which satisfies all the criteria. And if you were, you know, I'm a former engineer, and, you know, if I was to approach an engineering problem, that's one of the ways you would go ahead and try and figure out what's the best solution to this. Over the last several decades, centuries of public policy in the field of public policy, there's been a push for more of a scientific, and by that, people usually mean factual and unbiased, approach to developing, choosing, implementing a policy option. But unfortunately, in the real world, that's often not as easy as said, in part because there's other things that come to play. As a mentor of mine once said, you not only have the policy itself, but you also have the process and the people in the process, both of which can play as a bigger role or bigger than whatever your scientific methodology or framework is behind the decision. So slide five, this then gets to some of the shortcomings of this traditional scientific rational approach to policy analysis, which was identified back in the 60s and 70s. And the question was being asked, you know, are we getting better at solving problems? Because it seemed like there were, at that time and to today, there's a wide range of public policy problems for which we don't appear to be making any progress. And That is despite bringing more and more scientific tools, more and more big data, other, more and more people and other things to try and tackle them. The perception among some in the government and those out of the government is that, we are not making as much progress as we should on solving some of these policy problems. And the literature tends towards conclusion that it's partly because, or maybe in large part, because a lot of the easy policy problems have been solved, and many of the ones that are left are what's known as wicked policy problems. And slide 6 talks about this difference. So there's problems can be kind of characterized into two categories, tame and wicked. Tame problems, one can think of are things in mathematics, chemistry, chess, other fields, where there are clear, well-defined objectives and resolutions. There's rules of the game. You know when a game of chess is done. You know who's won. You know who's won, who's lost. And all of these kind of tame problems can be resolved through the application of a scientific method. On the other hand, wicked problems are the class of problems for which a purely scientific rational approach can't be applied. And why is that? Well, part of it is that you can't explicitly define all the variables. There's most likely forces at work or variables which you don't know about because it's some sort of a very complex system. The stakeholders, the people involved in the system or affected by it, might have radically different worldviews and timeframes, which means they might not even be able to agree on how to define the problem, let alone on how the best approach is. The constraints of the problem and the resources you have that may change over time, particularly if the problem is something that requires, years or decades to address, and the resources change over time, or governments come and go, that can be difficult. And then finally, wicked problems tend to be ongoing and persistent. Think of the war on drugs, or the war on poverty, or a host of other policy issues where you can't just come up with one approach, boom, it's done, it's solved. It's going to be an ongoing sort of a thing. So it turns out that most of the persistent public policy problems are wicked problems. And that means that, they're difficult to solve through a purely scientific rational approach. So on slide 7, if you look at those, if you study policy problems, particularly high-level policy problems, there's three models that have emerged for being able to understand the decision-making process, trying to factor what happened. The first is what we've been talking about, which is the traditional rational actor model. And in that model, the units are the cost and benefits of various options. The policy-making process is the creation of what's known as satisficing alternatives. And satisficing is a term of art from the public policy world. And basically it means, it's sort of like the lowest common denominator, but there's some subtlety to it as well. And the end result of the rational actor model is you pick the best alternative for the group. But there's two other models that have identified and shown to have been, having an impact to be able to explain things. One is the organizational behavior model, where here your units of measure are organizational outputs. And the process is divided up between the organizations. So you can model the system as basically organizations interacting with each other. And the way organizations make decisions is according to their own internal standard operating procedures and expertise. And the end result of the decision is the result of these organizational processes and behaviors. And then the third is governmental politics. There, the units are politics and, more importantly, the relationships between players in the system. The process involves working perceptions, dealing with parochial priorities, and what are known as action channels, which is another term of art of how people in the political system interact with each other. And the end result is usually determined by political bargaining games. Now, there was a very influential piece of work or a book called The Essence of Decision by a guy named Graham Allison, who used these three models and in part helped develop these three models and applied them to trying to understand the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what was fascinating about that book and that process was, you know, they basically went through and explained the outcome of the Cuban Missile Crisis three different times, each time using a different one of these models. And each of these models explained certain elements of the outcome, but none of them explained all of the outcomes by themselves. So that basically is a demonstration. People repeated this exercise across other decisions, but basically it shows, you know, these are just essentially three different lenses by which you can look at sort of the same process that's going on.
I've got a quick question about the example that you just used. Out of curiosity, it's that the using these different models for a decision making in the example of the Cuban Missile Crisis, did this interesting study that you did they play them out, and that resulted, or was it not really a game? Did they play it out such that the Cuban Missile Crisis ended in nuclear war?
No.
Or was it entirely?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
This was an analysis of the real-world crisis.
Right. It was not. They didn't play a game.
No, exactly.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. No. They used these to try and explain what really happened. So, for example, one of the things that's popped up in the Cuban Missile Crisis is, you know, why didn't the Soviets do a better job of hiding the deployment of the missiles in Cuba? And as it turns out, they basically picked up, you know, a mobile missile battalion from wherever their term is, from the Soviet Union, packed up on a ship and shipped them to Cuba and told them, go ahead and deploy. And so they pulled out their manuals and about how they deploy, and they followed them. And nowhere in that manual did it say, by the way, you need to hide your presence so that the Americans can't detect you because you're in Cuba. You're not in, you know, the taiga in the middle of the Soviet Union. And that was an example of trying to explain something where the organizational behavior was the reason why that explained that particular aspect of the decision. So part two here, starting on slide eight, but really slide nine, is I wanted to, that was kind of a primer about public policy writ large. I now kind of want to focus in a bit and talk a bit about space policy, and in particular, the interagency policy process, which is a big way that we make decisions in the space world. So on slide nine, there's generally four sources of public policy on space. The first are what are known as presidential policy directives, or PPDs. And those are issued based on recommendations that are developed through an interagency process in the executive branch. An example of that is the 2010 National Space Policy, which was issued by the Obama administration, I think it was in June of that year. And many other administrations have issued their national space policies. There's also been sectoral policies on GPS, on remote sensing. And so that first one is a big source of space policy. The second source are public laws enacted by Congress. An example is the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958. Which not only created NASA, but also established policy on what NASA will do, what its mission areas are, what it will focus on. And every year when Congress passes laws, either appropriations laws that give agencies and departments money, or authorizations laws, Congress can make policy. It can say, thou shalt do this, or thou shalt not do this, or this is how this agency will attack this problem. An example of that would be several years ago, where the NASA Appropriations Act put in a measure that, you know, said NASA is not allowed to engage in bilateral engagement with the Chinese on civil space without prior permission from Congress. That was a policy decision made by Congress. Number three are public presidential policy declarations. And the most famous example of this is Kennedy's moon speech. Which was not something that, you know, Congress didn't start with Congress saying we're going to the moon. It didn't start with a big interagency discussion. It came out of the White House and he said, put in this speech and we're going to go ahead and do this. Now, there had been some background work. You know, he'd been consulting with the NASA administrator and others beforehand. But, you know, presidents can make policy statements or establish policy goals using the power of the bully pulpit, which is an example of that. And then the fourth are international conventions and treaties, which the U.S. is party. According to the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. government signs a treaty. The elements of that treaty become law in the United States, become policy. An example would be the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, part of which says that you're not allowed to put weapons of mass destruction orbit around the Earth. And so, therefore, it is policy of the United States that we do not orbit nuclear weapons. So all these four are important, all play a role. The one I want to focus on for the rest of this presentation is the first one, which are these presidential policy directives, and more importantly, that interagency process that creates them. So on slide 10, this, most or many of the most important policy decisions are these PDDs that are signed by the president, and they are the product of interagency process. And the whole point of the process is to get input perspectives from all the different departments and agencies that have an interest. And the specifics of how the process works has changed over time because, each administration has free reign to do this however they see fit. And on slides 11 and 12, I basically give kind of a quick tour of the history of this process. So on slide 11, the Eisenhower administration, which is kind of the first administration to think about for space, because this is when the space age began. They used something called the National Security Council to issue PDDs, including the first national space policy at the end of 1958, which was kind of the cornerstone document that established a lot of the space policy objectives that have remained consistent over the last 50 years. The Eisenhower administration also created the National Aeronautics and Space Council, colloquially known as the Space Council. And the main task of the of NASC was to do civil space policy, try and figure out what NASA should be doing. The Kennedy administration largely continued the same, to have the NSC handling national security space policy and the Space Council to establish, continue to do NASA policy. The Nixon administration started to make some changes. They kept national security within the NSC. They created a special task group to do civil space, and at the end of the Nixon administration, they dissolved the Space Council. On slide 12, the Ford and Carter administrations, they, again, largely handled national security within the NSC, and they made a change where they kind of pushed civil space down to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, which is part of the White House, but it was a bit less of a priority in terms of what had previously come as something that, for example, the vice president is directly leading it. The Reagan administration kept it almost entirely within the NSC. They created something called the Senior Interagency Group on Space. Now, there were several SIGs in the NSC, but they had one on space that handled pretty much all of space policy. The first Bush administration resurrected the National Space Council to handle civil space, and they once again reassigned the vice president to lead it, and they continue to use the NSC for national security space. Slide 13, the Clinton administration made another fairly significant shift. They created something called the National Science and Technology Council, the NSTC, and the purpose of the NSTC was to handle high-level decision-making on all science and technology policy. And they considered space to be part of S&T policy. However, in reality, the NSTC didn't actually make any space policy decisions. They actually, for all intents and purposes, used the NSC process, although OSTP, under the direction of the vice president, were the ones leading things. The W. Bush administration, formally took space from the NSTC and put it back under the NSC. And so this was a case starting in the Bush administration where instead of having two separate processes going on for space, they basically centralized all of space policy within the NSC. And they had OSTP working with the NSC to lead those decisions. And then currently the Obama administration, when the Obama administration came into office 2008, there was an initial look to see that they would bring back the National Space Council. Ultimately, they decided not to, And they have kept the process largely the same as under Bush, where they're using the National Security Council process, the NSC process, with OSDP and NSC kind of jointly leading that. So slide 14, what is this NSC process I keep talking about? The National Security Council was established in 1947. It's chaired by the president, and it's a bit confusing because there is both a council, that is the NSC council body, and there's also an NSC process. So the council, the body itself, is chaired by the president, and the membership are largely cabinet officials. So the secretaries of defense, transportation, commerce, all the other major cabinet positions. The purpose of the NSC is to formulate debate issues that would then go to the president for a decision. Now, under the first Bush administration, the process by which the NSC worked out these decisions became something sort of a three-tier model. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But the point was, you know, instead of having this, the principals, the seniors, spending all their time on every problem, can we come up with a way to solve problems at a low level and only elevate the things that we can't get resolved at a lower level? Slide 15 has an example of two different National Security Councils. On the left, you can see the Clinton NSC at the end of the Clinton administration in 2000. And on the right, you can see the Bush NSC in 2001. It's only a year later. And they're pretty radically different organizational charts. Again, the NSC is completely under the administration, and it is up to each administration to decide how it wants to organize it, what issues it wants to have in there. And it's interesting, the Bush NSC in 2001, 4 or 5 years later, they had even changed their own structure radically because of, you know, the wars in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. They had to remodel their own NSC because of events that happened in the course of their administration. Side note here, on the Clinton chart, the little number in parentheses are the number of people that are in each of those departments. So, for example, on Asia, you've got six. On Europe, you've got six. The top box on the right of the Clinton chart says defense policy, arms control, and eight. So there are eight people in the NSC working defense policy and arms control. Only one of those works space. And that's stayed true till today. So the Clinton NSC was roughly around 100 people. Today in the Obama administration, the NSC is approaching 400 people. But out of those 400 people, only one person is dedicated to working on space issues. Slide 16 is a more in-depth look at this three-tier process I mentioned. It starts with what's known as an interagency policy committee, although each administration tends to rename it whatever they want to name it. But you can think of these as kind of the subject matter experts in each organization, each department and agency, that are brought together to start discussing a particular policy issue. And they formulate, they're drafting a policy. And what when they reach a part of the decision that they cannot resolve, then that gets elevated to what's known as the deputies committee, which is made up of the deputy secretaries of all the departments. And then if they can't resolve the decision, then they convene the principals, and then eventually it goes to the president for a decision. But the entire point is to, again, resolve at the lowest level so as not to waste the time of the higher level decision makers. Slide 17 has an example of one of these. In the 1993, the Clinton administration convened an IPC to look at GPS policy. Prior to that, you know, GPS had been in development for a decade or so. It had just started to come in service in the very early 1990s. And the Clinton administration decided that it needed to issue a presidential policy on GPS to clarify whether or not it was really a dual-use system, to deal with some of the civil and national inequities. And so they created an IPC that was co-led by the National Security Council Space Director and the Assistant Director for Space from OSDP And, you know, these are basically just the permanent members of the IPC. The agencies are on the outside. At times, there were as many as 15 to 20 people that are part of the IPC. And over the course of 2 years or so, they would meet every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and they hammered out a policy decision. And at the end of it, that went to the president, it was signed, and it became the Clinton GPS policy that was issued in 1996. Slide 18 is another example from the Bush administration. They called these things PCCs, Policy Coordinating Committees. You can see on the left-hand column, there was a number of these that the Bush administration established as kind of standing PCCs across space commercial, transportation, spectrum, space control, national space policy. And each of these had a lead or a co-lead agency and a number of agencies that were part of it. And these standing PCCs would basically be called upon to discuss, debate, and provide options in each of these categories when they would come up. So that's it for the what I want to just touch upon about kind of how this process for doing the interagency process has evolved over time. The last piece of this I wanted to go through are some of the big issues, policy issues that are currently being debated, and that are probably going to be debated in the next 4 years, 8 years, and into the future.
So I got a question on the PCCs.
Sure, go ahead.
So the PCCs that were submitted do not guarantee any kind of appropriations to fund them, correct?
You're exactly correct. This entire interagency thing is internal to the executive branch. And you can think of it as a way of the executive branch debating within itself about what it wants to do. The interaction with Congress is something different.
And none of it really becomes real until that appropriation process gets executed.
Well, it depends. There are certain things that are under the purview of the president. For example, foreign policy, military strategy, diplomacy. Granted, there are debates about, how much of a check and balance does Congress have on this versus the executive branch. But there are decisions that the executive branch can make. For example, that Clinton GPS policy I talked about at the time, the big issue was something called selective availability. When GPS was originally created, it had both a public signal and it had a protective military signal. And the military put selective availability on the public signal, which was a random error up to 100 meters. And the point of that random error was to make it not useful for militaries because they didn't want the U.S. military providing a capability, GPS, that somebody else could use for military functions against the U.S. Well, as GPS grew in popularity, there started to be other users for which SA became a problem. And the big one was the aviation community. At the time in 1993, you had the FAA was building a system called the Wide Area Augmentation System, WAAS, whose point was to undo the selective availability so the FAA could use GPS for air traffic and aviation safety purposes. So you had one agency, the FAA, building a system to undo something the other agency, the DOD, was putting in place. So one of the big features of the Clinton GPS policy was they decided that they're going to turn such availability off within 10 years. That decision was made in 96, and they eventually turned it off in 2000. And that's an example of a decision where they could do that without Congress's without any additional money from Congress. Now, obviously, if Congress had chosen, they could have passed a law that says, no, you will not turn that off, or tied funding to keeping it on. And that's where things get complicated. But, to wrap it up, there are a set of things for which the executive branch can do things that probably won't require money.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yep.
So starting on slide 20, I've listed a couple of topics across civil, national security, and commercial space, and a couple others that are, you know, being discussed. They're kind of, you know, big issues floating around Congress, around the administration, you know, kind of in the beltway, and are likely to be debated in the next administration. So on slide 20, under civil space, should be probably not a surprise by the end of the call, but one of the big policy issues is what is the future direction of NASA's human spaceflight program? The current administration has set to the goal is that they're going to, you know, redirect an asteroid in orbit around the moon, and they're going to go send people to go visit that. There are others who say that no, the U.S. needs to have a Mars program where they go directly to Mars and none of this, you know, lollygagging around other destinations. There are still others who talk about the need to go back to the moon, in part because that's where most of our international partners want to go. They want to go back to the moon, for them to go to the moon. And within each of those, you know, what degree of international cooperation will they have? Will it be the kind of, you know, U.S. lead that everyone else kind of follows along in the tailcoats? Or will it be a program where, you know, the international partners have a significant stake in it and play a significant role? And will China be included in that list of international partners? So that's a very big civil space public policy question that the next administration will most definitely be tackling. Related to that is this question of what is the relationship between NASA and the private sector? At the moment, we have these commercial and cargo and crew programs where NASA is developing or helping the development of commercial services to provide cargo and crew transportation to the space station. That started as a policy decision in the Bush administration and has continued in the Obama administration. And so that raises a bigger question about, are there activities NASA has historically done that are perhaps better suited for the private sector to do? And if so, how do you make that transition? And what does that mean for the future of NASA and NASA's workforce and you know, how NASA is organized? And the other, you know, big space, it's not the last, but the other, I would say, you know, kind of most salient policy issue for civil space is how to ensure policy to stability for NASA. As I hinted at in the first bullet about the direction of the program, unfortunately, NASA has sort of been, you know, getting pulled left and right by different administrations, and in some cases at the same time by Congress and the White House. Almost like, you know, I've used the analogy before, almost like a kid with two divorced parents, and the you know, the parents are fighting over the child. And that's in part because NASA has a very big big visibility within the public, with the media, with internationally, big higher prestige. And so for a lot of people, NASA is the space program, for better or for worse. So there's a serious question about how to ensure this policy stability for NASA. Because if every 4 years or every 8 years, NASA is being told to go do something else, that makes it very difficult to build the kind of organization and accomplish that's needed to accomplish long-term goals. So there are ideas being floated about perhaps the NASA administrator has a five-year fixed term, sort of like what the FBI director is, in the hope that that would decouple the NASA administrator from politics, although, as we've seen, that's not necessarily worked out that well with the FBI director. But, you know, maybe the NASA administrator is appointed by a panel instead of by the president. There's ideas floated around about how to fix it. So on slide 21, on commercial space, the big issue here is that in the last few years, there's been a marked change in the commercial space sector globally, but primarily in the U.S., to where it is doing things that previously were the domain of only governments. And in some cases, the commercial companies are planning to do things that have never been done before. And the challenge is that under the Outer Space Treaty, Article 6 says the U.S. is responsible for authorization and continuing supervision of its private sector space activities. At the moment, that is done through, largely done through a process of regulations and licensing. So there are three government agencies, NOAA, FCC, and the FAA, each of whom has been given authority to license a particular, to regulate a particular aspect of commercial activities in space. And they largely do that by having entities come get a license. So in the case of NOAA, they have purview over remote sensing of the Earth from space. So if you create a satellite, U.S. company, and make a satellite that is going to take pictures of the Earth, you need to get a license from NOAA before you can launch and operate your satellite. FCC has purview over spectrum use. So if you're going to use radio frequencies to communicate with that satellite, you also need a license from the FCC. And the FAA has authority over launch and reentry, but not on orbit activities of commercial launch vehicles. So if you're SpaceX and you want to go operate a launch pad or launch your vehicle, or you're Virgin Galactic and you want to recover your vehicle, you reenter, then you have to get a license from the FAA. But there's a whole bunch of new or innovative activities that don't nicely fall into one of those three buckets. On-orbit satellite servicing, refueling, removing space debris, private space stations, asteroid mining, lunar habitats, all of those, you know, it's you can kind of, in some cases, maybe fit them into one of those buckets, but it's really hard to see how you'd fit all of them. And in some cases, those existing licensing processing agencies don't have the competence to be able to properly, you know, determine or license these activities. I could talk, other people are talking about doing commercial radio frequency remote sensing, i.e. SIGINT, signals intelligence. So there's a big question about, A, how do we modernize the existing regulatory regime to make it easier for companies to get these kind of licenses, but also to provide the kind of certainty that companies say they need. Some of these companies are being told by investors that we're not going to invest in your company until you get some sort of certainty or some sort of a license from the government that says, yes, you can go ahead and do this.
Excuse me, Brian. Hello, Brian.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Brian, this is Dan Luster. I can't resist giving this input about this, which federal agency should do these things. It has always astonished me that the Space Act, which of course defines the role of NASA, never mentions human spaceflight. And so in principle, you could say, well, gee, where does NASA get the charter to do human spaceflight at all? Is that applicable to what you're talking about here?
So NASA certainly would have the expertise,
right?
But
right.
NASA is not a regulatory agency, right? It does not, as far as I know, or as far as anywhere, it does not have any power to regulate the private sector. It doesn't have the tools that those other agencies, NOAA.
That's a really good point you're making. You're talking about specifically regulatory agencies.
Yes. But to your point, you know, some of those regulatory agencies don't necessarily have the expertise, right? So, for example, does any of the, you know, would you feel comfortable with the FAA, you know, talking about how to operate a private space station? Well, they certainly have the regulatory tools or framework, but they don't have the expertise. So this is part of the challenge. This is why it's a wicked problem, right? Is that if you can't just say you go ahead and do it, because there's not a clear answer that's immediately, you know, obvious to everyone is the best answer. That's why there's a big discussion going on.
Right.
And then related to that is this issue, policy issue of what is the role of the government related to the commercial sector? Is the government an investor? Is it a customer? Is it a partner? Is it a competitor? Are there other roles? This has been a theme throughout space policy since the beginning. There was, you know, I think starting in the Reagan administration, there was a strong push that the government should be investing in and kind of encouraging commercial activities in space. But in some cases, you know, the commercial activities bump up against or compete with government activities. So clarifying which of these roles or which role is appropriate for which sector is going to be a pretty significant policy issue. And then on slide 22, national security. This has been in the news quite a bit the last year and a half or so, 2 years. Should be no surprise, the U.S. has become very reliant on space for national security and military power. And at the same time, counter space and satellite capabilities are proliferating. So there's, you know, there's much more of a case that in the future conflicts, there's probably going to be a space element of the conflict. And so the question the military is dealing with is how to deal with this increase in what they consider to be a contested space domain. You know, how can they increase the resilience or assurance of U.S. military space capabilities? Not necessarily protect a satellite, because that can be very, very difficult, but how to ensure that whatever capability was being provided can withstand an attack on a particular one particular satellite. There's a discussion about should the U.S. develop new offensive counter-space capabilities of its own, in part to deter adversaries or in perhaps to counter their own capabilities. And related to that, you know, how might the U.S. deter potential adversaries, such as Russia and China, from kinetic attacks on space in future conflict? And then how best to leverage commercial industry and allies in that mix of resilience and assurance. And slide 23, I've got two left to talk about here. On slide 23, I labeled this cross-domain because this is an issue that cuts across civil, commercial, and national security, and that's what to do with space being a more of a congested domain. There's at least somewhere around 500,000 pieces of space debris in orbit, and there are plans to launch something on the order of 9,000 new satellites. That's a typo there, but planned in the next decade. And so the question is, how do we manage this in a sustainable and efficient manner? You know, there's been a lot of focus on mitigating or minimizing the creation of space debris, but at some point we're going to have to remove space debris. Who's going to fund that? Which agencies are going to be responsible for doing that? Who's going to pay for it? And then related to that, there's a lot of discussion in the last couple of years about space traffic management. You know, do we put in place a more robust system to manage on-orbit activities to kind of prevent some of the worst things that might happen from all this congestion and collisions? Does that start with an international discussion or an international treaty? Or does that start with one particular country, like let's say the United States, putting in place something nationally that then is extended internationally? And related to that space traffic management question, you know, where do you get the data about what's going on in space? You know, at the moment, the DOD handles all of space situation awareness, and should part of that be moved to a civil agency? And then finally, on slide 24, there's a question about the future of the interagency process. Once again, you know, the traditional civil, military, commercial barriers are continuing to break down, and there's a discussion of how should the policy process evolve. Some people want to bring back the National Space Council. How might that interact with the National Security Council? You know, who's leading this? Is it NSC? Is it OSTP? Is it another entity? All of those are going to be questions for the next administration. So, with that, that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm willing to open to answer any questions anybody else has for the remaining few minutes.
Great. Thank you. This is Harley. Got a question, which may be a slightly far field, so this may be more of an intellectual assessment is an intellectual curiosity. Do you know, is there roughly a comparable process within the European Union? And so I presume there is some kind of process. And given the how very different the European Union is structured and that it does not, it's not entirely contiguous with the European Space Agency, how does it work?
It's complicated. So I'll say first off that many countries do space policy and have to make these kind of decisions.
Right.
But very few of them have a dedicated process just for space. You know, the U.S. simply just has far more people working on space and space policy than pretty much everyone else combined, at least as far as I've been able to tell. in the specific case of the EU, you got to remember that the EU is a collection of sovereign governments. So when, you know, part of it, a big part of it is each of the countries within the EU needs to figure out what their position is on space. And then they all get together and they have another whole EU level function. So you can imagine, you know, as difficult and complex as it is for the U.S. to make decisions, you know, add another layer on top of that, which would be the U.S. negotiating with a bunch of the countries who are all part of the same federalized system. That's sort of like what happens in the EU. And as you said, yes, ESA is a separate entity from the EU. Not all members of ESA are members of the European Union and vice versa. Although over time, ESA has sort of become one of the ways in which the EU implements decisions. But anyway, it's very complicated. I barely understand it myself, and we used to have somebody in the organization that lived in Brussels and, you know, helped explain it to us full time. But needless to say, they don't necessarily have a dedicated process. They, as far as I can tell, they basically use a lot of the same processes they use to make regular policy decisions to make their space policy decisions.
Brian, this is Dan Dumbacher. I have a question for you. How does, I noticed in your charts, I didn't see any reference to the Office of Management and Budget, and I'm still not, I would like to get your read on how you see, even though this is internal executive branch you've talked about, how do you see it working with Congress, particularly given the fact that there will be an obvious transition of some form or version that will be happening over the next year or so?
OMB definitely plays a role, but it really depends upon the specifics of the administration. In the current administration, as far as I can tell, OMB has played a very prominent role in a lot of things, in that they have kind of served to enforce budget discipline upon much of the executive branch. And any kind of crazy ideas anybody wants to get in kind of has to pass through the budget wicket in order to get approved, at least by OMB and the White House. So I would say that, you know, yes, in this particular administration, OMB plays a huge role. That has not always been the case in previous administrations. It very much depends upon the power structure of each administration, how they choose to kind of, you know, collaborate and put things together. Now, of course, OMB, you know, the way the Constitution is set up, Congress has complete power of the purse. So no matter what OMB says, Congress can always do whatever they want to do. OMB's primary job is to kind of help put together the president's budget, which Congress usually uses as kind of the baseline and then makes tweaks off of that. But Congress doesn't have to. Congress can kind of do whatever it wants to when it comes to budgeting. As far as transition, yes, that's already underway. All the major agencies, including NASA, have already, you know, there's a law in the books from a few years ago that kind of moved up the transition process to earlier in the election cycle. So all the agencies and departments have had to put together the transition teams, whose job it is to kind of put together briefing materials for the next crew that's going to come in. And each of the two major campaigns has created transition teams for all the major topic areas and for all the major agencies. And so those transition teams are going and talking to the agencies and departments and getting briefed on, these are the big issues we're working on, these are the projects we have underway. And the transition teams are then also working on lists of appointees. So by the time, you know, and that'll kick into high gear after next week, once we actually have, hopefully, an elected president, then between that point and January when they're inaugurated, that whole nomination the transition process kicks into high gear. People will, you know, will start to get phone calls about, you're going to be the next secretary of this, or we'd like to ask you to be this. And so that'll be, that's always fairly complicated, but there's actually a very good process for kind of figuring it all out.
Do you think that, I'll just ask it this way. How do you think the relationship with Congress, what are your expectations in terms of the relationship with Congress and the executive branch on this subject?
Well, so I think the tea leaves suggests that we may have a divided party between the White House and Congress, or at least the House once again. So I can't say that I expect great things out of that cooperation overall. But on space, I will say I think there's a lot of recognition within both parties that, you know, that there needs to be a better job of coordinating between the White House and Congress than perhaps has been done over the last several years. And I've heard that from both Republican and Democratic, space policy people that are, you know, working with the campaigns, or at least, you know, involved on the periphery of the campaigns. So I would hope, and I sort of expect, that the next administration will at least, you know, try and work with Congress on at least the NASA question about, can we all get together on what NASA is going to go do? But, you know, as often is the case, sometimes there are bigger picture politics, partisan politics that get in the way and can muck all that up.
This is also a little bit of a speculative question. One realizes that a good number of these national policies and actions, although probably not all of them, are determined by various and increasing doses of bribery. The question is whether anyone that you know has analyzed the issue of how much have bribes determined space issues.
I'm as someone who has spent the last, you know, few years examining a couple of decisions made in the Clinton and Bush administrations, I'm not aware of bribes being involved in the process at all. The beneficiaries of these, first of all, private companies aren't allowed a direct role in these interagency decisions anyways. They would have to act through government agencies. And, I mean, that may be the case in other policies, if you look outside of the space world, but I have never seen any evidence of that in the space world.
Very good. Do we have other questions? Other questions?
Yes. Hi, guys.
Go ahead.
This is Eric Levinsky in Cleveland. Brian, I have a question that's kind of related to something you just said and also to an earlier question on satellite frequency allocations. I'm in the private sector, and I also do consulting and contracting for NASA. And especially with the new space crowd in Silicon Valley, we all hear about small satellites and, revolutionary technologies and so forth. But when it gets down to it, when you talk about things like frequency allocations, they do tend to basically blow it off. They kind of wave their hands and say, well, we'll sort of take the Uber approach and we'll go in there and we'll manage to get the frequencies. But, you know, the physics is physics and there's only so much spectrum to go around. And you just mentioned that the private sector is not allowed to get involved in these interagency decisions. I'm just wondering, with this advent of new space, with the, particularly in NASA's case, the bias now toward supporting the commercial new space, do you see a point at which the involvement of the private sector is going to be more formalized, sort of like it is in the International Telecommunications Union? Do you see more of a standing committee and high-level policy analysis arena that would be composed of CEOs and so forth? Thanks.
I agree with you on the kind of the new space approach to this stuff. Many of the ones we interact with, they tend to, they're a bunch of engineers, maybe a couple of MBAs, and so the policy regulatory piece tends to be the last thing that they focus on, although some of that is changing. There's recently a group started up by Planet to look at kind of coordinating, kind of like a group to kind of look at coordinating spectrum issues. So I would say there is a move, I would say internationally, to look at how to bring in non-state actors, including corporations and the private sector, into policy discussions. Within the U.S., that's going to be hard because there are laws on the books that are put in place precisely to address what the previous question was about, bribes or undue influence, where there are fairly strict laws about what the government can and can't do in terms of interacting with the private sector when it's making a policy decision that could result in contracts or those sorts of things. So I think that you're going to see probably more informal coordination between the private sector and the government. But as far as a formal role, my understanding is that would mean a pretty significant change to some laws that are on the books for things like bribery and corruption.
Okay, that's good information. Thanks. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is Martin McLaughlin. Doug Lavero in OSD is working space policy and very smart guy. Which of these three processes do you think he mainly uses, or probably all three?
Well, yeah, no. Doug is very much a very smart guy. So he is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Space Policy,
right.
Which, you know, when you decode that, basically means he's in charge of figuring out space policy for the DOD. He works on Secretary of Defense. So if you go back to, the slide I showed on slide 17, which was, for example, the Clinton IPC on GPS, he would be one of those boxes. So the box in the far right that says DOD Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisitions Technology, at the current era, that will be filled by Doug or somebody from his staff. So when it comes to the interagency, the DOD is one entity among a whole bunch of other departments and agencies. But of course, the DOD has its own policy process that it has to go through to come to its own policy positions before it goes out and talks to other agencies. That helps at all.
Yeah, that's clear. It's part of a much bigger set of policies than just space, too. It's all national security.
Yeah, and one of the things you see in the interagency process is, you know, the DOD is by far the biggest entity, the biggest bureaucracy within the process, particularly compared to things like transportation or commerce. And so it takes the DOD a long time, and they tend to be very much less agile than the other entities, which can cause friction when it comes to this interagency process. But once the DOD makes a decision about what its position is going to be, and the full weight of the department comes down behind that, that could be an extraordinary obstacle for another agency that is trying to change that.
Right. Okay, we're a few minutes after the hour. We own this phone line 24/7. Are there any additional questions, if Brian's willing to hang on a bit?
I'm okay for a few more minutes if there are.
Sure. Additional questions, folks? Okay, Brian, excellent presentation.
Hello?
I think we got another question coming in.
Hi, Brian. This is Steve Lee DeGoddard. I was wondering about the congressional side of all this. If you could just say a few words about how Congress fits in with this executive branch that you've been talking about.
So they kind of have their own process, and that could take a while. That's a very in-depth thing. But if I could just briefly summarize it, it basically comes down to the committee structure. So the way Congress is organized is each the House and the Senate has a whole big set of standing committees, and each committee has a certain set of topics that are under its purview. And there's typically a committee for both appropriations, which deals with money, and a committee for authorizations, which deals for, you know, what departments are allowed to do. So, for example, in the case of the DOD, there is the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee, and those two committees basically set the authorization for the DOD. It says the DOD should go do this, we'll go do this, spend money on this. But then there's also House and Senate Defense Appropriations Committees, and those two committees actually allocate the money. So at the minimum, you're basically going to get four committees in Congress that affect each agency. In the case of NASA, it's the Commerce, Science, and Justice Committee, I believe. Again, there's four that involve it. But if you then expand out to the FAA, that falls under Transportation, Housing, Urban Development. So that's a set of four more committees. And each of these committees, that's kind of how how Congress works, is they work through the committee structure, and you have to figure out which committees have oversight over a particular area, and then look at both the funding part of it and the authorization part of it. And that is how Congress makes decisions.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, one last quick question if anybody has it. Otherwise, Brian, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.